Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Milford, Chair of the Club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Patrick Arbour. Dr. Arbour began his career in the field of aging in 1973. He is the founder and the director of the Center for Elderly Suicide Prevention and Grief-Related Services, a program now of the Institute on Aging in San Francisco, where Patrick also serves as the Director of Staff Development and Leadership. As the author of numerous articles and book chapters on bereavement, suffering, suicide prevention, and more, Patrick is concerned with the healthcare professionals. He's co-authored a chapter entitled Suffering and the Caring Professional in When Professionals Weep, Emotional and Countertransference Responses in End-of-Life Care. He is a senior lecturer in the Human Services Division of Notre Dame de Moore University in Belmont, California, a part-time lecturer in the School of Social Work at the University of California, Berkeley, and conducts workshops and presents lectures locally and nationally on aging-related subjects. Dr. Arbour received in 2002 the Gloria A. Kavanaugh Award as co-recipient for excellence in training and education in aging, presented by the American Society on Aging. Let's welcome our speaker tonight, Dr. Patrick Arbour.
Okay, thank you, and make sure everybody can hear me. And it's always nice to hear about that American Society on Aging Award, particularly when Gloria A. Kavanaugh is sitting here. So it's very nice to have her here and other friends that I know. So I'm very glad to be here. I was glad that John had invited me to speak to you tonight on a topic that is pretty serious, whether this is something that you are looking at for yourself or maybe an parent or grandparent. I think that these are very difficult times that we are finding ourselves in. And one of the things that we've seen at the program that I direct at the Institute on Aging is that we have a 24-hour telephone line called the Friendship Line. And the Friendship Line is designed for people generally around 60 or older who are trying to figure some things out, and they may not have the resources that they need in order to do so in a way that feels positive to them. And so some of the things we're going to be talking about during this period of time have to do with grief and loss, fear, anxiety. And what we see on the Friendship Line is that there has been an increasing kind of need for people to try to talk about what's happening to them as they are concerned about their finances in particular. That many of the people who call us are dealing with incomes or pensions that are pretty fixed. And they're finding themselves looking at the future, and it doesn't look as secure as it did 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And so they find themselves kind of struggling with some emotions that isn't something that they have been used to. And that's one of the reasons when John had asked me if I would be willing to do something on this, I was very happy to do it, because I think the more of us who are knowledgeable about some of the feelings that are connected to some of the problems economically, the better off we're going to be as a society. I was giving a talk similar to this a couple weeks ago, and I pointed out to the audience that I am not Susie Orman. And I think that's very important to keep in mind. So questions about what to do with your finances, it's not my area of expertise. But the feelings associated with it, one of the things, I mean, I find her very interesting, and one of the things I hear her say is, don't make stupid mistakes. And how we do that sometimes is when we're feeling really anxious, when we're afraid. And so she really urges, you know, kind of a calm mind when you start to look at what you're going to do with your funds. But sadly, what I find is that a lot of people get very anxious, and so they make decisions very quickly and impulsively, and they're not dealing with the, you know, kind of the long-term consequences of those decisions. And that usually has something to do with fear, anxiety. And so those are some of the things we're going to talk about. But the program has this 24-hour line, and it's been in operation since 1973. So even during some of the other economic hard times that we've had, I'm very happy to say that the 24-hour friendship line continues, where somebody could call and it can be anonymous, confidential. Sometimes people just need someone to talk to at 10 o'clock at night. You know, the world doesn't end at 5 p.m. You know, things continue, and sometimes people need to talk. We also have a medication oversight project that is designed to help people stay at home if somebody could help them remember to take their medications appropriately. We have grief services and that kind of thing. And if you have an interest in any of this, you can always contact me, and you have my information there. But this is what we want to look at, is that there have been a lot of traumatic changes in people's experience due to this economic downturn. This recession has been compared to the Depression in the 1920s, 1930s. If you have parents or grandparents who had gone through that or were children of that time, they might be having feelings that they didn't expect to have, that they really thought they were secure. They worked for Pac Bell. They retired, you know. But their portfolio took a tremendous hit. And that was not something that they had expected. The state of California is grappling with this deficit, which is very problematic, and we hear that the legislature and the governor signed the budget, and then there's like, oh, but now they might have to reconvene again, to, you know. So it just feels very unsettling. And again, if you are concerned about your finances and you keep hearing these things, it just triggers the possibility of anxiety and feelings, again, that you're not quite used to dealing with. Retirement portfolios are decreasing in value. I just talked to a gentleman the other day who is not yet 70. I think he's 68, 67. And what he was saying was that for the first time in his life, he finds himself really worried about his financial security. While at the same time, unfortunately, he's going through a divorce, and so that is a very complicated thing. His business has all but dried up. He's still working. He's not retired. And he had a health-related condition and had to have it was a minor procedure. But for him, he said, this is the first time in my life that I feel vulnerable physically, financially. And he said, I don't know whether I'm going to survive this. And he said, and I have thoughts of suicide. He said, I'm not going to kill myself. But he said, I just don't like this business of living alone and not having the financial security and then all the stress of the divorce and what that's going to mean. So, you know, I think that these are real issues for people that they didn't necessarily think they were going to have to deal with. Threats to pension and health plans. A lifetime of savings disappear. A lifetime of really being serious and thoughtful about saving, and then we see what the market does, and then that really affects when you look at your whatever 401k or what, and to see, oh my God, it's down 300,000. Well, that's a lot of money, and that can be really, you know, breathtaking if you were really counting on that in terms of your retirement or what's going to happen to you down the road. And of course, people wonder then, what's next? You know, what's going to happen next? And there's this gnawing apprehension in many of us, you know, that, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. One of the other things that I hear a lot of people talk about, and some people in this room probably hear this too, is that people are saying, even though I'm 65 or 68 or 70, I have to work. You know, that idea that I'm going to retire in my early 60s may not be a possibility anymore. You know, and I think that that's, again, something that people have to get used to and adjust to. But that can also trigger some fear, apprehension, not only in terms of money, but also in terms of the workplace. Is the workplace going to be sensitive to me, who is an older worker? Or are people going to be whispering in the lunchroom, why doesn't he retire? You know, he's old, he's over the hill, he's 61, you know, get rid of him. And I'm 61, so. But there's more going on than just the money. There's more going on, and I think we have to kind of pay attention to that. You know, people feel confused and bewildered. When will this change? You know, even I heard on the news the other day, and some of you probably heard that too. I listen for any little words that sound like, oh, the recession might be shifting. You know, you might have heard that. I think it was last week because the market did fairly well last week. And you know, it's like, oh, my God, I'm really, like, paying attention to that. Will I feel better, you know, if one of those morning people say, oh, the recession is shifting. And then I hear today the market went, I don't know what the market did today, but in the early morning it was down. Was it down today? Okay. So, you know, so we kind of are living and breathing the stock market, which may not be something that we always did. And again, there are no easy answers to these complex economic questions. And that can also add to our frustration because we like to solve things. You know, we like to understand things. We want to feel more secure. But that may not be available right now. We experience fear and panic because there's a blurred vision about the future. It doesn't look as secure as it did when we were 40 or 30 or whatever. So what we have to do is we got to figure out a way to manage the bewildering experience that we find ourselves in. You know, what am I going to do? You know, or I talk to people in their 80s and 90s who say, I really wanted to leave something for my grandchildren, and that may not be possible. One woman said to me the other day, she said, we've always owned a house in Tahoe. It was our country house, and that she wanted it to go through the generations. And she said, I have to sell it. And she said, we've had it in the family for years, and I wanted my grandchildren to be there, but I have to sell it because I need the income. And she said, I didn't expect to be 92. And she said, I'm still here, and I need a little bit more cash, and I just don't have it. So I think there's a lot of grief that comes along with recognizing that I have to have some limits, where before I might have had a little bit more flexibility. So what we have to do is that we have to look at some of these deep feelings that get triggered. And so we want to understand fear, for example, and its close cousin anxiety. And that's what we're trying to talk about tonight is how do I manage these strong feelings that are somehow connected to the economic downturn, you know, that where I once felt very secure, that's changed, that's shifted, and I'm not so sure anymore. So we need to recognize the impact of grief, of loss, and find a way that I can manage my emotions during these darker times. Because if I can do that, I'm going to be better off. You know, I am going to feel more grounded, and the decisions I make aren't going to be cluttered by a lot of intense feeling so that I'm impulsive where I need to be very thoughtful. And if I'm working with a parent or grandparent or adult children, I need to be able to talk to them in a way that doesn't trigger their anxiety. You know, so it's a complicated thing. So if we think about fear, for example, the phone that rings late at night, 2 a.m. Now, we know that can't be good news. You know, and many of us have had that call. And you know that feeling of, oh, my God, as you go to get it or to call your answering service. That is very troubling, and that's fear. You know, here in San Francisco, and particularly our office is on Geary Boulevard, crossing Geary Boulevard is a risk every day. Market Street, you know. You know, somebody's on their cell phone. You've heard all this information about people texting the other day. I was driving along Geary Boulevard, and I just happened to look at the person next to me, and he was in a big SUV, and he's texting like crazy. And so when the light turned green, I went, but he was still sitting there because he was in the middle of a text, and I thought, you know, what do we need to remind people that maybe that's not such a good idea? A dog without a leash lunges at you. Your physician gives you bad news. What's next? You know, and fear gets triggered by these kinds of events. But the good news in fear is that we know what threatens us. In fear, we know. We can say, you know, this event happened and it triggers a fear response in me. I have a little bit better handle of it because I know there's something threatening me. And so we have a lot of energy. One of the things about fear isn't necessarily a bad thing. It can get you moving. It's kind of like anger. If anger is managed in a healthy way, you can get some things done. You can make some decisions that you might have been sitting on for a long time. Keep in mind, emotions equal energy, you know. So if I can move these feelings, you know, I might be able to make some changes that feel a little bit better. The problem is oftentimes when we have a strong feeling, we want to repress it. We want to hold it down. And that's one of the things that we're kind of taught in our society is to stuff it, you know, so that we look good on the outside, but we feel crappy on the inside. So we have to be kind of alert to that and to use our perceptions in a sharper way, a more strategic way. What am I experiencing? You know, what's really going on? Can I talk to somebody about this? Can I share, you know, these thoughts or feelings with other people? So what we do when we have fear, we take steps to run or overcome the danger, the flight or fight response, which you're all familiar with, the sympathetic nervous system. And I go into this just because that fight or flight response is so apparent, and yet we tend not to see it. You know, we tend not to see it in our parent or grandparent or adult child. What they're doing is they start arguing with us. We say, well, you know, maybe everything will be okay. They say, how do you know? What, are you a mind reader? You know, are you Susie Orman? That's why I use her as a reference. You know, it's like, no, but maybe if we could calm down. Calm down! How can I calm, you know? And so you can hear that here's somebody that you care about who's your pal, your friend, your son, daughter, parent, and they're fighting with you because that's the way they're trying to manage that feeling. Or they want to run away, like the gentleman I was referring to earlier who said, you know, I'm thinking about killing myself. What he was saying, and I just said to him, I said, I know you want to escape from these problems. You know, the divorce is really hard on you. The fact that you're not working at the capacity that you had been working. So 2 years ago, you were really busy. Now you barely have, you know, any more contracts. And so you want to run away. And that's why you're thinking about killing yourself. Suicide is a great escape valve. Not the best. But it's an escape valve. It's what people do when they are unable, you know, to manage. And I always say with any group this size, there's always people that have been touched by suicide. And we don't know to look at them that that might be the case. But I'm going to read in a few minutes a suicide note by somebody who was an older gentleman. But he makes it really clear how economic woes can trigger this flight response. And the combination of fight and flight can turn into rage against the self because I don't know how to manage this. You know, anger, rage is one of the most difficult feelings that we have to figure out how to handle in our society. We're a very violent society. And then with these problems financially, we can see how this kind of increases the desperation in people's lives and they want to do things to relieve their own financial problems, but then they do difficult things. You know, Bernie Madoff and people like that. There's a wonderful writer. His name is Harry Lewis, and he wrote a book, Excellence Without Soul. Excellence Without Soul was his book. He was a former dean of Harvard, and he said one of the problems that we do, he said what Harvard did is that it really put a lot of energy into unleashing the intellect of all these wonderful, bright people. But he said the thing we forgot was to teach them how to be good people. And And what they became was greedy. And so we see how a lot of these things that you've been hearing about, all these different big, large companies, how could they do these things to stockholders or whoever, employees, participants, because they wanted something that they shouldn't have strived for. They might have been better had they striven to be good people. So proper functioning of that autonomic nervous system is crucial to survival. And that's part of the underlying foundation that we're trying to talk about tonight that may not be for you, but it may be for people that you know, is to help them and to understand when they do that fight or flight response that you're going to have some awareness of it. Many of you took Psych 101 or more and bumped into this along the way. But I think we forget when people are anxious. We forget when they're really upset. We forget when they say, I don't think that I can stand this any longer, the tension, the scare, the fear. And we have to be able to reach out to them in a way and say, hey, I think I understand what you're going through. Understand. I want to understand what you're going through. The problem with this autonomic nervous system is that it can be disrupted by anxiety. And a lot of people, and you know this, that you know people who are really anxious, but you say to them, how do you feel? What do they say? Some version of fine. I'm okay. What's wrong with you? You know, like to have a feeling is like, oh my God, can't have a real feeling. But people get anxious and they don't acknowledge it. And so we want to be aware that anxiety can really get in the way and can be triggered by these bad news that you hear all the time. Anxiety is a feeling that could be described as being caught, overwhelmed. You know, many of the people that I work with, that I see, are feeling overwhelmed. They don't know what to do, you know. Like the woman I was saying who has to sell her Tahoe house, she just said to me, she said, I am totally overwhelmed. Her husband died a year ago. The adult children are all unhappy about that and anxious about it. And she has to sell the property. And they don't want her to. But she said, what else am I? I have no choice, you know. And so she gets overwhelmed and then maybe makes decisions that are not necessarily the best at this time. What I say to people all the time, Gloria knows this, that I tell them to ponder. Sit and ponder. You know, let yourself really ponder what's going on. But try to calm the anxiety. You know, try to calm the fear. And that's not always easy to do. And so instead of becoming sharper, our perceptions become blurred or vague when we're anxious. You know, people will stay up all night. You know people like that. Can't sleep. They're so worried. But nothing changes because they didn't sleep. Nothing got better. In fact, things are just probably a little bit worse because they're very cloudy, right? But they'll say, but I have to think about these things. I have to worry. You know, my mother, many of your mothers were in that category. My mother said, well, that was part of her job description, was that she was a mother, she had to worry. But I said to her, but if that was such a good thing, what changed as a result of it? Well, nothing. But that was hard to admit. So we want to just pay attention to that, that worry isn't necessarily going to solve things. So how do we experience anxiety? Well, it's on a continuum. Sometimes it's slight. You have a little bit of a flutter in your stomach if you're going to give a presentation or whatever. And anxiety can also be very paralyzing. So we want to be aware of it. And that's what I said earlier about that gnawing apprehension. You know, we want to draw our attention to the opportunity or the ability to be aware of what's happening to me. But if I am worried sick, if I am feeling overwhelmed, it's going to be hard for me to really get a grasp on what's going on, what's happening to me. You know, I don't know. There's a constriction of the chest, a general bewilderment. I've never been through anything like this, or I have been through some things like this, and I don't want to face it again. A feeling of a heavy weight, you know. You often will see people kind of staring, you know. I remember my mother was in a very stressful period of time, and she would be sitting there at the dining room table, and she was just sitting there, and I know she had no idea that time was going by. She was just sitting there staring because she was really anxious. and just didn't know what to do. And so when you see people doing that, you really want to say something to them. You want to tap them on the shoulder and say, can we talk? You know, there's something going on. Can we talk? Fear, again, may be a threat to one side of the South. For example, our stock values decline, and we're having a bad day in terms of whatever it is that we have. Property values have decreased, whatever. But anxiety arises when the threat becomes big enough to kind of swallow up my whole person. That now I'm saying all of my holdings, all of my assets has taken a tremendous hit. I'm selling my property. You know, people are doing it. They're selling their properties at below market value, or they're not going to make a profit. In fact, they have to pay to get rid of it. That's a terrible feeling when you thought, boy, my house was going to be my nest egg, you know, and now that isn't proving to be accurate. Anxiety strikes at the core of ourselves. So our whole existence feels threatened, and that's one of the things that has to do with depression. Oftentimes people think if you're depressed, you're not anxious, but that's not true. People who are depressed can also be anxious because we know, particularly with older adults, that older adults have the highest rate of suicide of any age population. But to die by suicide, you got to do something. You know, you have to take some steps. There has to be some method. The method that is most widely used is firearms for older people. So what we know is that there's something here that anxiety accompanies the depression. You know, if somebody were really only depressed, they couldn't get out of bed, and some of us have felt that way at some point in our lives, we just don't have the energy. But if you have some anxiety on top of it, and you believe your perception is that my existence is threatened, it can be very troubling in terms of some of the thoughts that you have. And so we want to learn how to talk about those kinds of things. The other thing that often happens is panic attack. You probably know people that have had panic attacks. Have you known people like that? Sometimes you might yourself have had a panic attack. I've really never had a panic attack until a number of weeks ago. And I woke up at night, and this was probably 2 or 3 in the morning, and I was hearing this kind of felt like a drum sound, boom, 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 boom. And I thought, what is going on? It's 2 o'clock in the morning. And I just lay there, and all of a sudden I realized it was my heart. That was me. That was the boom, boom, boom. And I realized that, oh, my gosh, I was having a panic attack. And because I realized that, I was aware that this is what it is. It's not dangerous, but it's very uncomfortable. But a lot of people, and you know people like this, who will then race to the hospital, to the emergency room, because they really think they're having some kind of a major heart problem. And what it is anxiety. And that's important, but it's not dangerous. And so panic attacks are these kinds of symptoms, but you have to have 4 of these in order for this to be diagnosed as a panic attack. So palpitations, trembling or shaking, sweating, shortness of breath, chest pain, discomfort, nausea, etc. But you have to have 4 of those. And this is often told to people when they go to the emergency room because they really feel like they're having a heart attack. But what it is anxiety. But again and again, I come back to how hard it is to determine what in the heck is that that's triggering this. You know, I need to very thoughtfully look at what are the factors that are going on that are triggering these kinds of experiences. A panic attack essentially is a fear response. Something I am is threatening me. There's energy there, but I don't address it. And this is what I think happens, and what I'm seeing happens with a lot of people who are struggling through this financial crisis, is that they're not talking about it. We've got to communicate. You know, you want to connect. Connection is paramount. I want to be able to say something to someone who cares about me, who is not going to ignore me. I need to say, I'm anxious, I'm worried, I'm not sure what to do. Can we talk? You know, again, the feelings around panic have to do with just kind of shakiness, goes back to that bewilderment. I'm just not sure what to do, what's going on. A panic attack can be very frightening, but it's not dangerous in and of itself. So what can you do about panic attacks? And that's the other thing that we want to be able to look at tonight is just what are some of the ways? What are some of the ways that I can manage some of this? Or if I have a friend or family member who is experiencing panic attacks, you know, we can talk about that. Sometimes medications can be very helpful, you know, to kind of help ease that panic response, that fear response. Cognitive behavioral approaches, if you're thinking about therapy, can be very helpful because one of the things you want to do is teach people, and that's kind of what we're doing tonight. It's really a cognitive approach to this whole issue of the feelings that come up during these hard financial times, is that a cognitive behavioral approach, it's really an educational approach to understand what is panic, what is anxiety, what is depression. That's what we're trying to talk about tonight, so that when you have a feeling like that, you can respond in a more positive way, whether it's for yourself or others. Just applying very basic breathing techniques. I had somebody who was in crisis this afternoon who just kind of dropped into my office, and she was just, you know, you could just feel her anxiety was so intense. And you know that feeling when somebody is very anxious, and then you start to almost feel like, gee, I'm anxious too, which is not necessarily the best thing to do if you're working with somebody who's anxious. But what I just did, I just stopped her and I just said, I know you're trying to tell me things, but because you're sobbing and you're trying to talk, that just kind of increases your inability to communicate. So I said, either let's just cry or let's breathe. And so I just sat there and breathed with her. And really, within 5 minutes, she was able to talk. And she was able to cry. But some of these techniques are so simple. Just breathe. We want to increase the level of oxygen in the blood, which then reduces many of these symptoms. That anxiety is going to subside somewhat. But you can just ask somebody just to pause. Let's just hit the pause button. That can be extremely helpful. And then the person can kind of regroup a little bit. But we've got to admit what's going on. What's really going on? And that's what this woman said to me then. And it has to do with the estate. Her dad died. The estate took a major hit. She thought she was going to have X amount of money. It's much, much less than what it was supposed to be. And that's what she was really anxious about. And then, of course, she felt like, well, maybe I was a bad daughter and blah, blah, blah. But the idea was that she had to talk about that. And she had a lot of conflict. I love my dad, but he really, you know, made some major mistakes with the finances. Blah, you know, and so there's a conflict there. And what you want to help people do is to draw their attention or your attention to the conflict. Anxiety is often connected to a conflict. Did I do the right thing? No, I probably made a mistake, but I did the best thing I could at the time. You can, and that kind of verbalization is a real reflection of an anxious state. Then, as we talked about worry a little bit ago, and please, as we're going through this, if you have questions, we're going to address them at the end. Worry is also a form of anxiety, as I said, and that can just be, again, crippling to a person's ability to look carefully at the reality. Let's look at the reality. Maybe it's not as bad as you think it is, you know. And I love this quote, worry does not empty tomorrow of its sorrow. It empties today of its strength. And I think that is a really powerful way of looking at that, that worry is not going to be very helpful. The other thing is that a lot of people are walking around with generalized anxiety disorder. They've been anxious for a long time. And so now with this economic downturn, that is a triggering event that kind of triggers this anxiety. And because they don't experience the anxiety, because what they do is that they make it about something else. So they don't say to you, I'm really feeling anxious. I need to talk to you. This feels pretty big. But they act it out instead. You know, so they don't actually sit there and tell you what's going on. So they never confront it, and thus they're never able to overcome it because they never say what's going on. They never say something about, you know, I didn't have much money when I was growing up, or, you know, I put so much faith in the stock market or real estate, whatever they did, and then that's not working for them. And what's really being triggered is this old fear that they lived with as a child or as an adolescent, deprivation, but they don't know how to talk about it. So if you can't confront it, it's going to be hard to figure out how to overcome it. You know, how do I overcome something that I can't talk about? And many people are saddled with, I was thinking about this last night as I was preparing this talk, how many people don't acknowledge feelings? You know, Daniel Goleman in his book, Emotional Intelligence, what he said was in many ways, we are becoming a society that does not feel. You know, that we just don't feel. To feel is to be, ashamed. You know, you're split open. Everybody can see. Rather than feelings basically acknowledge to us our human condition. We're just human. We have this intellectual, we have this physiological component, we have a spiritual component, we have an emotional component. But it's really tough for a lot of us to be able to acknowledge feeling. It's called alexithymia, which is the inability to acknowledge how we feel. And so we need practice, you know, we need practice. But we also need time in order to do that. We need to be able to talk to one another. We know that this is a stressful time. Can we talk about these kinds of situations? So what do we do about our fears and anxieties? Well, one thing we can do is we can admit them. We can just say, I am worried about my financial security. I'm worried about, you know, what's going to happen to me. I'm worried that I'm going to have to work till I'm 80, you know, and, you know, or longer. And will I be able? I mean, this is what is plaguing a lot of people in their 60s and 70s and older is, who will want me? You know, and that's a tough place to be. You know, when you've got talent, you've got experience, and you need to work. You know, will people respond to me? Take risks, you know. Let me tell somebody what's going on. Acknowledge the positive that maybe I'll be able to get through this. You know, together with my family, my friends, I'll be able to manage this. We've gotten through many other things. I can get through this as well. Avoid catastrophic thinking. You know, one thing we can do is control the thoughts that I have. You know, I can say to myself, Patrick, when you go down that street of thought, you're just getting yourself worked up. That doesn't seem to be helpful. You know, as tempting as it is to catastrophize because it's very dramatic and it's very, you know, powerful in that way, it isn't helpful. So you want to stay in the present. How is it today? How am I today? Am I okay today in this moment? And in this moment, everything seems pretty good, you know. At 4:45, I was a little anxious, but I had John and Candice here, so I changed. So we can look at this. And as I said, general anxiety and major depression share genetic influences, and so they can operate together. Virtually everyone with depression shows anxiety, and that anxiety often precedes the onset of depression. But for many of us, men particularly, it's very hard to admit that I'm depressed. I wanted to read something to you, just a very brief passage. Terence Real, some of you may have known about him. He writes a lot about relationships, marriages, and he's been on TV. I've seen him on, like, Good Morning America, that kind of thing. And but he also has written this book called I Don't Want to Talk About It. And this is a book that those of you that have fathers, brothers, husbands, sons will say, you know, we really need to talk about whatever this is. It's a problem of some significance. And what your husband, father, brother, son might say is, I don't want to talk about it, as a way of kind of pushing it aside. And what it might be more so is a way of saying, I think I'm depressed, but I don't know how to talk about that. Terrence Real, he's a licensed clinical social worker, was himself depressed and could not get any help because no one would recognize it. And here he was, a practitioner, and he knew he was depressed, but nobody was listening. And he said it was particularly difficult for him as a man to get someone to be able to treat him. He writes, one of the ironies about men's depression is that the very forces that help create it keep us from seeing it. Men are not supposed to be vulnerable. Pain is something we are to rise above. He who has been brought down by it will most likely see himself as shameful, and so too may his family and friends, even the mental health profession. Yet I believe it is this secret pain that lies at the heart of many of the difficulties in men's lives. Hidden depression drives several of the problems we think of as typically male. Physical illness, alcohol and drug abuse, domestic violence, failures in intimacy, and self-sabotage. We tend not to recognize depression in men because the disorder itself is seen as unmanly. Depression carries to many a double stain, the stigma of mental illness and also the stigma of feminine emotionality. Those in a relationship with a depressed man are themselves often faced with a painful dilemma. They can either confront his condition, which may further shame him, or else collude with him in minimizing it, a course that offers no hope for relief. Depression in men, a condition experienced as both shame-filled and shameful, goes largely unacknowledged and unrecognized both by the men who suffer and by those who surround them. And yet the impact of this hidden condition is enormous. You know, and it's so tough. You know, one of the things when I, you know, when you read the little blurb about this, managing these feelings, it's one thing to think about it philosophically. It's another to encounter your son or husband or brother or father who you can see, sense, feel there's something going on, but they won't tell you. And one thing I also say to people is that I say to women, don't think of your husband's, brother's, boyfriends as girlfriends. They're not girlfriends. They're not going to respond to you in that way. They're men. And they may not be sure. They're not withholding. They just might not know what's going on. You know, it's very tough, you know. And that's why I love this book. I don't want to talk about it because he really makes it clear because he's also talking about himself. You know, and then when you're in any kind of a stressful situation, any one of us under protracted stress may behave differently than what we think today. Stress, worry, anxiety. Is going to get in the way. So we need to, one of the lines here that I think is so powerful is the cognitive interpretation from the feeling the need to be on guard about a potential danger to questioning one's ability to handle the potential danger. Anxiety is the need to be on guard. The depression is I don't think I can handle it. You know, and that's what we want to reach out to people and say, I'm here. I'm your wife. I'm your brother. I'm your sister. You know, I'm your friend. I can help you, you know. Oh, well, you can't, you know, bring back the portfolio. Well, I can't do that, but I can say I'm here. You know, we're here. You know, somehow we're going to get through this, you know. We're very innovative if given a chance, you know, but it's hard to be creative when we're depressed. And that's something that we have to kind of ponder. So one of the other issues here is grief and loss. You know, this gentleman that I said who's in his late 60s and, you know, he really needs to work now because of the cost of this divorce is so out of control. But his contracts have dried up, you know, because everybody's pulling back. And so he's very, very stressed. And he said, everything I looked at in terms of my older age has gone belly up. It's not the way I thought it was going to be in my 50s. He said, I thought I was going to be retired at 65, maybe doing some consultation. But he said, I have to work. And it's not the way it was. And I said, and what we need to do is we have to grieve the assumption. You know, your assumptive world has changed. And in our society, this society, we don't even acknowledge death, let alone assumptions. You know, and that's something we have to be able to help people face and look at, which is my assumptive world has changed and there's loss attached to it. You know, so loss is an event. Grief is a dynamic process. So, yeah, there's something called this economic downturn, crisis, whatever. That's the event. But how I deal with it, how I respond to it, is this dynamic process. And I have to admit sometimes that I don't know what to do. You know, I have to admit that I made a mistake or, you know, I'm feeling, you know, some despair. Well, those are aspects of grief, you know, that we want to pay attention to. So that process of grief, psychological, behavioral, social, physical, it's not surprising for people to come to me at this time with these problems with finances to say, and I've also been feeling sick for the last 6 months. I don't know what's wrong with me, they say. And what I say is, well, did you go to the doctor? Blah, blah, blah. Yes, I did. And they can't find anything wrong. And then I say, well, maybe what's wrong is you're not expressing your grief. And it's taking a physiological path instead of, you know, so it's confusing your system, you know. You want, and we're a quick fix society. I want somebody to fix it. Well, those of you, and I'm sure everybody in this room has grieved. Grieving is a process. It doesn't happen, you know, overnight. It's a continuous process and it involves changes over time. Different kinds of losses, external losses, losses of body parts, financial losses. These are tangible. We know it. We can see that my bank account has changed. And with that bank account changing is all sorts of other kinds of issues that I have to pay attention to. Or psychosocial losses, as I said, assumptions about the future. Those are more internal. But also complicated. You know, I've got to figure out how I deal with these. Then there's traumatic losses. Losses that are sudden, unexpected, violent. You know, homicide, suicide, accident. I mean, when you see in the papers, I was very caught by that woman. I don't know where she was, but she was driving on the wrong way on the freeway, and she had her daughter and several nieces. A number of people died, and then they said, well, there was alcohol in her system. Yeah. You know, it's like alcohol is not going to solve it. You know, do we have to be numb? We don't have to be numb. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with having a glass of wine. My goodness, there's wine out there. So, you know, I'm not the alcohol police. Oh, God, I'm not. But I'm talking about people who have to get numb, you know, because they can't think. And they only say, I have to think my way out of this, rather than I have to talk to other people. You know, this is not something I expected. I don't know what to do with that. You know, so I need, and the other problem that happens if we don't grieve our losses, as I said, secondary losses will occur, and these coincide with whatever the initial loss is. The initial loss is I lost all this money or my investments have really suffered. Oh, my gosh, and now there's other things that have happened as a result of that, and I need to have some place, some safe place where I can talk about that. Or else I'm going to feel really isolated. When we're isolated, we're vulnerable. Isolation is very different than solitude. You know, many of us need to have some solitude, but not isolation. So you can see what affects the grief process, you know, the type of loss it is, the significance of the loss. You know, how did we learn about the loss, the characteristics of the loss? Is there any support provided? Are things that we need to pay attention to. There's a wonderful, a quote by Pat Conroy. And Pat Conroy is the author of Prince of Tides. And this particular quote is from his book, Beach Music, if you're looking for a book to read. And, you know, that's a wonderful book if you like Pat Conroy. But one of the characters talks about a death that he had encountered. And he's a middle-aged man. And he said, I could feel the tears within me, undiscovered and untouched in their inland sea. These tears had been with me always. I thought that at birth, American men are allowed just as many tears as American women. But because we are forbidden to shed them, we die long before women do, with our hearts exploding or our blood pressure rising or our livers eaten away by alcohol because that lake of grief inside us has no outlet. We men die because our faces were not watered enough. And I think that's a very beautiful way of trying to capture something that's very complex, you know. How do men grieve? How do women grieve, for that matter? And so we need to be aware of what we can do about that. How am I doing with time? Am I okay time-wise? 5 minutes? Okay. So anyway, we want to be aware of difficult grief as well. Feelings of loss can be bewildering, as we said. We can be disoriented, and that can make a very big difference in how we go on. One of the things that I often hear because of our grief programs is, well, is grief going to be a year? I think I can handle this for a year. Well, it's like, well, no. You know, whoever came up with that year thing, I would like to talk to that gentleman, because I have not seen that actually work. Although I think what happens is that, you know, we, with support, with help, with counseling, we can manage to do something healthy. Rather than grief ungrieved is going to turn into depression, anxiety, or addiction. If I bury my grief, I'm going to have a hard time working through that. So what can we do then? Well, what we can do is that we can listen to people. We can listen with acceptance. We can just accept people as they are. Talk to your husband, father, mother, sister. Actually, take the risk and say, could we chat? Could we talk? Reassure. Acknowledge the loss. Stay present. Don't disappear. Dr. Jerry Motto says, it's very important that we stay connected because connections bind us to life. We might not like it, but it binds us to life. Discourage impulsive decisions, look at options, express and experience your feeling, and ask what is really important? What is really important? You'll see in your handouts that there's other information that you can look at as well in terms of what are some other ways in which I can stay present, you know, that I can stay focused, that I don't have to lose my sense of center, my core, because I'm having some financial problems.
Thank you, Dr. Patrick Arbour from the Institute on Aging. Will you take questions from the audience? All right. I will ask the lovely Candice to come forward and pass the microphone so that our listening audience can hear the questions.
Hi, doctor. I'm just curious what you talked about depriving oneself. I'm feeling like with my financial worries right now, I don't even want to buy any clothes or take myself to lunch, or I'm just trying to be so careful. And I'm just, you mentioned that in your lecture. I was just curious about that.
See, and I think that that's a real important response that many people say, which is, I'm not taking a vacation this year, or I'm cutting back, I'm not going out to dinner. But what we have to be careful is that some of those activities really trigger aliveness in us. The importance of having dinner with friends. I mean, I think there's nothing better than to have a group of people or a couple people get together for dinner. That could be not as costly as you think, you know. But what we do, we make these decisions, and they're often very intense. Okay, I've got to cut out all these things. And yet many of those things give our life meaning. So what we want to do, rather than cut them out, what we want to do is reconfigure. So if my budget, I used to maybe eat out twice a week or whatever, and it cost $150 or whatever, $200, well, maybe I can go to somewhere else that isn't as expensive, rather than cutting it out. See, that's one of the things that I think is a stress response. I cut many things out, including things that really mean something to me. And then what I feel like is I feel deprived, you know. And so can I look at it differently so that I don't have to cut everything out? But I might have to just kind of reconfigure it. because you might feel bad, you know, and yet we're saving money, but I'm feeling bad at the same time. So you want to see how can I shift that around? Somebody else have a question or a comment? Gloria.
I'm going to approach this from a little bit different direction of the professional who's experiencing this personally, but also is dealing with, as you talked about, all of these cutbacks in the California budget, and so therefore, you know, they're not being able to provide their client, their customer, their patient, the care that they would really like to, so that's adding to their distress, their anxiety, and so I know that wasn't really the approach you were taking with this talk, but I think it's another very important aspect.
Well, I think for any of us in the room that are professionals, whether in human services or other lines of work, is that I think what Gloria is saying is that we might find ourselves very stressed as well because of cutbacks in the office or you know, any kind of reduction in service or people not being hired once they go. And so you might wind up, as I was thinking about your question, which is I might be working harder. I'm not earning as much, but I might be working harder, and now I'm depriving myself. What I think people have to do is communicate. I really, really urge communication. And you know, whether that's at your job with your supervisor or manager, I think it's really important that we talk. That we say, you know, just as you did, which is, you know, I'm cutting all these things out, but I'm not feeling so great. You know, I'm working harder, and I love what I do, but I'm working harder, but I'm getting less done because we don't have the services or whatever. But again, I don't think that there are magic solutions to it, but I think that there are opportunities to try to talk about what's going on. Try to find ways, as I have in your handouts, to kind of allow yourself to get centered. You know, I think things like meditation, yoga, although yoga isn't something that I would pick, but meditation is something that I would. And that can be simply taking a walk in beautiful Golden Gate Park and just allowing yourselves to be in nature. You know, when Oprah Winfrey had Eckhart Tolle on, you know, and everybody kind of went crazy. I think he had a lot of really important things to say in terms of being in the present, you know, just being in the present. But to be in the present, you've got to be able to be who you are, you know. And so I think whether we're talking about social workers or we're talking about, you know, adult workers or retired persons, I think we all want to be as much of ourselves as we can be. But that means I have to be in the present moment. And that's tough. Candice.
You know, what you were just saying reminded me of in July, Craig Nathanson spoke here. He's a vocational coach, and he wrote a book called Don't Just Retire and Die. And one of the things that really struck me about what you just said was he was recounting being in a coffee shop, and he was observing two people. One was frenetically on his cell phone talking about how concerned he was about being out of work, and he's going after every single job he can get, and he's spinning his wheels, and he was just full of anxiety. And then there was another woman in the corner doing a jigsaw, crossword puzzle. And he spoke to her, and he asked her what she was doing. Well, she too had lost her job. But she was taking the time out to kind of give herself a break and find that place you were just talking about. And when he said that, I just thought, I didn't get it at all, but now I understand it.
See, and I think that that's what often happens when we are threatened by something, that we start running. You know, that's the fight or flight sensation. I start to run because I'm afraid. I'm afraid that I won't have income, or I'm afraid something bad is going to happen. So I start running as fast as I can. I love that expression, spinning your wheels. And we know when we're spinning our wheels, nothing good is going to come out of that. But what the other woman was, I'm just going to sit here for a while. Just going to sit. Do my crossword. You know, I'm just going to pause. And maybe as I pause, something's going to come to me. You know, I'll have a better idea of how I'm going to move in my life. But if I'm racing, and many of you know that when you are running multitasking, Lord have mercy, then we stumble. Rather than I just need to be a bit more aware of myself. I'll close with this. Mary Pfeiffer, who is an author that many of you know, she wrote Reviving Ophelia, Another Country, and others. And she has a book called The Shelter of Each Other. And I'm going to paraphrase it, but in the book at some point she says, you know what we have to do? We have to get back to feeling strong. And instead of living in denial, we want to experience resilience. But resilience happens as a result of community, whether we call that community family, whether we call that community friends, whether we call that community coworkers. We need the shelter of each other, however we define that. And what can happen is we can get together. So you were talking about meals, and she's the one who says, get together, potluck. Get people to come together and sit down and eat together. Play softball is one of her others. Experience joy while at the same time you're trying to manage some of these serious issues. But she said, just be connected. Irvin Yalom says, connections are paramount. As I said, Dr. Jerry Motto says, connections are what bind us to life. The way to manage in difficult, hard economic times or other times is to create relationships that are meaningful. And I hope that this has been helpful to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Our thanks to Dr. Patrick Arbour of the Institute on Aging for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as the listening audience. And now, the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.